in practically every middle and high school science course, we learn the concepts surrounding the atom and its building blocks. I say this with quotation marks. We often hear definitions of the atom along the lines of, and I quote, the smallest pure substance that cannot be broken down. I don't really need to quote there, but like, you know what I mean. We are reassured by the end of the cataclysmic demagnification of the physical properties of the world. We basically fret at the cell, the molecule, and the atom, but it is nice to know that it all ends with the atom and its subatomic particles, the proton, the neutron, and the electron. Because of the fact that this is not a middle school or high school science class, and because of the fact that we are science nerds, and because of the fact, again, that we are, that this is a real science class, not that science classes in middle school and high school are not real science classes, though they are futile in comparison with modern science and should be taught to challenge students more effectively. I wish that you all listening to me have taken a hint at my sarcasm, because this is not a middle or high school science class, and we are not talking about why the atom is made of a proton and a neutron. The proton is positive and the neutron is neutral. The electron is negative. We are learning about something new today. And that is that the atom is most definitely not the smallest particle, and most definitely can be broken down into smaller pieces. Even the protons and the neutrons that we considered to be fundamental particles in and of themselves can be broken down into smaller particles. In an attempt to open your minds beyond the delusion that the atom cannot be broken down, this chapter is to convey and communicate the building blocks of the building blocks of the building blocks of the building blocks. Of atoms, which we have alluded to oftentimes in previous chapters, but have not really covered it in depth, or chapters or episodes, as you may say. But anyways, we're discussing quarks, the wondrous building blocks of everything that deals with subatomic particles, excluding the electrons, so specifically the proton and the neutron. We're going to be talking about what creates the hadrons, what creates the baryons, what creates composite elementary, well, not composite elementary particles, but composite particles. In chapter 26, we discuss supersymmetry, basically the symmetries between the fermions and the bosons. This episode covered a topic that was quite new, having been first pondered and speculated only 55 years ago, which even in the scientific world, is a fantastically novel discovery. Still not really that novel, because look at how much has happened since we discovered the quark. Like, enough has happened. Like, we've discovered the Higgs boson, for example. There are all too many other things. Well, I think we've discovered Hawking radiation in that time. We've imaged a black hole. We've observed them. I could probably name a million more things, but I'm blanked right now. But I'll tell you, there are a million more things. But still, 55 years is a fantastically novel discovery. Like, it generally takes half a century to even a century for a hypothesis with no observational evidence to become a distinguished theory. I mean, that's at least from what I've seen in my time. Like, this is not an accurate estimate. It may be completely incorrect, completely unfathomable, but there is potential that it is around 50 to 100 years. That is what I've seen and what I'm assuming. But yeah, the young ages of so many of these paramount scientific topics indicates to us that there is yet so much to be learned about the universe in which we live, and that brilliant hypotheses can become brilliant theories in very short time. This does not include supersymmetry, though, as it has yet to be discovered or observed in CERN or basically anywhere, because, yeah, that's supersymmetry. It's a very complicated thing to observe, but if we observe it, it'll change everything. And when I mean change everything, it will change everything. But anyways, this chapter's topic, quarks, of course, is no different. The quark model itself is only 57 years old, except this discovery is paramount and very obviously true, because we've seen all of it. Like, we've actually observed quarks. I mean, depends on what you define as observed. But anyways, before we venture into the history of this discovery of the quark, it is important to know some background on the subject. Before this discovery of the quark, there existed what was colloquially referred to as the particle zoo. This zoo described a massive list of what were then considered to be elementary particles. Most of the particles detailed on this list were hadrons, which are composite particles and are not elementary particles in any way, shape, or form, but rather made of elementary particles. In the early 1960s, there were hundreds of hadrons known to exist and believed to be individual elementary particles, except, again, they most likely were not, most definitely were not elementary particles. though they were subatomic particles. It had been believed that the proton and the neutron, two baryons, a baryon is a type of hadron that contains three quarks, were elementary particles in and of themselves, and that they could not be broken down into a plethora of particles. Of course, as we are about to find out, this speculation was disastrously wrong, and it seems to explain why physicists often say they believed that the elementary, that, they believe that the elementary particles listed, like the leptons, quarks, bosons, etc., are in fact elementary particles. That makes sense because, again, we like to say in the scientific world, this is how much we know. Like, this is what is known. But we don't have the whole frame of reference. Like, I like to think of the hottest star in the universe, like the Wolf-Rayet star. There might be a Wolf-Bayet star or something that's much hotter, much greater. So, like, the hottest known star in the universe is not the hottest star in the universe, but it's the hottest star that we know of that is hot. It is the hottest of the hot stars that we know of. But again, when our frame of reference is 100,000 stars, and there are, what is it, like 1 septillion stars in the universe, it seems a little unrealistic to say that that is the hottest star in the world, in the universe, or anywhere around us, or even in the Milky Way, or even in our neighboring region. But that kind of explains it. Like, in the scientific community, we like to say this is known so far. This is what we believe. But again, there's a lot of room to be wrong in these novel scientific topics. In these novel scientific topics, there's a lot of room to be wrong. But like, the reason why is, like, there is certainly a possibility that even the elementary particles we considered so now to be elementary particles can still be broken down. Like, think about that as you ponder which field you plan to explore as a potential career. If I were to say anything, I would say choose particle physics or theoretical astrophysics, because it may seem like a crazy topic, and yes, it is certainly a crazy topic. It is certainly a very difficult topic, but if you love to do it, you will love it for the rest of your life. It is the kind of job that you will want to have, and you will continue to want to have for the rest of your life. That is why I'm going into. I'm actually kind of in an ethical dilemma right now. Well, moral dilemma, career dilemma right now, because I am kind of conflicted between majors. I want to go into physics, obviously, but I'm conflicted between astrophysics and particle physics. I have a friend of mine is a major good particle physicist, and I have so much fun talking to him about particle physics, but I don't have any friends that are astrophysicists. That's a problem. But that has nothing to do with it. But I found particle physics to be extremely interesting, and astrophysics to be almost just as interesting, pretty much as interesting, and it combines astronomy as well, so I get to actually, like, look through telescopes and stuff, which is literally my favorite thing to do in the world, but again, like, that's kind of my problem. But if I could say anything, just go into theoretical astrophysics, go into cosmological physics, go into particle physics, you can even go into classical physics. We don't even know everything about classical physics yet. There's still a lot that is yet to be learned in physics. So if you are really interested in science and you're my age, go into physics. It's a great field. But anyways, in 1964, two physicists by the names of Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig, I think it is Zweig or Zweig, I'm not sure, Zweig, who's not to be confused with Stefan Zweig, who is an Austrian novelist, they discovered and proposed independently the existence of quarks when conducting studies on strong interaction symmetries in particle physics. So strong interaction, that's a strong nuclear force, one of the four fundamental forces. If you really want to explore more on the fundamental forces and specifically the strong nuclear force, you can search up what the strong nuclear force is, or you could go to episode 19, of course. At the time of their discovery, there existed the particle zoo discussed earlier that had a significant number of hadrons widely considered to be elementary particles. The two physicists both propounded that hadrons were not elementary particles, but rather composites of three different flavors. Actually, it was three different flavors. I was kind of correcting myself. Flavors are essentially species of quarks, so like different types of quarks and anti-quarks. So at the time of this discovery, it was believed that the three quarks were the up quark, the down quark, and the strange quark, which is odd that the strange quark is the one that's third. And the two physicists pondered that these three quark flavors could explain the characteristics of the hadrons, which they do if you think of the charge of the proton and neutron, for example. Like, the neutron's made of two down quarks and an up quark, and the proton's made of two up quarks and a down quark. You have a plus one charge for the proton, and you have a zero charge for the neutron, technically. Less than a year later, the physicists Sheldon Lee Glashow and James Bjorken, I believe it is, predicted the existence of a fourth quark flavor, which is the charm quark, which equalized the number of known leptons with the number of known quarks, which is both at four, and bettered the description of the weak interaction and its effects on quarks. The weak interaction is responsible for the decay of quarks and thus the decay of subatomic particles, and then thus the decay of atoms or radioactive decay. And formulated a mass formula that accurately predicted and identified the masses of various mesons. Mesons are hadrons composed of an equal number of quarks and antiquarks. So, quark, antiquark. So, up antiquark, down antiquark, charm antiquark, strange antiquark, top antiquark, and bottom antiquark. We'll get into that later. Subsequently, in 1968, again, only 3 to 4 years after the initial proposition of the existence of the quark itself, and not the hadron as an elementary particle, the discovery was confirmed by the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, or SLAC, which is a particle accelerator, as it was discovered that the proton was made of point-like objects and was therefore obviously not an elementary particle. It was still not widely believed in the astrophysical, the particle physical community, and the physics community, as generally we had almost like a moral dilemma here. There was just a dilemma on almost some of the math of it, and just kind of its it just didn't seem accurate. It was a little more out there when it came to theories. Another famous physicist who was a major opponent of the quarks, actually probably the most profound opponent of quarks, known as Richard Feynman of everyone, called these point-like particles partons because they remain reluctant to identify those point-like particles and proton as quarks. Again, this is because of other reasons. It has nothing to do with biases. It has more to do with just kind of scientific inadequacies that were later resolved. But anyways, there are six currently known flavors of quarks. There's the up quark, the down quark, the top quark, the bottom quark, the strange quark, and the charm quark. That's that memory right there. In 1977, the bottom quark was discovered in Batavia, Illinois' Fermi Lab. I say Illinois, not as in I do not know how to say Illinois, but rather as I know, like I'm possessive. That's what I mean. In Fermi Lab, it's the Fermi Lab accelerator. And subsequently, in 1995, Fermi Lab again discovered the sixth known quark flavor. They didn't discover the sixth known quark flavor again, but they again made the discovery of the quark, of a specific kind of quark, and this time it was the top quark. Since then, no new quark flavors have been observed, but there remains a possibility that more exist under our collective scientific noses. Generally, it's not believed that there are many more, because the leptons and the quarks, they're supposed the same count of it. So you have the electron, the muon, and the tau for the leptons, and then you have the neutrino variants of each one, basically. So you have the electron, muon, tau, and then you have the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. That's six. And then you have the six quarks. But anyways, the discovery of the quark allowed for scientists to better understand many of the various forces, most notably the weak nuclear force, and better understand the structure of the atom, of course, because quarks literally compose the protons, literally compose the neutrons. Not the electrons, though. The electrons are particles in and of themselves. The quark became an imperative structure of the Standard Model. If you want more information, see episode 19 or look it up. And for that matter, a fundamental concept of the basis of modern particle physics itself. Now that the quark's history has been ascertained, it is important to understand the quark itself. What is the quark? What is its importance? How do quarks relate with the rest of the universe? The quark, because of its half-integer valued spin, is classified as a fermion. We discussed this in great detail in episode 26, the episode on supersymmetry. And also we somewhat discussed it, not really, in episode 19. To go off on a tangent, all known elementary particles have either half-integer spins or integer spins. From all I've seen on the differences between the half-integer spin particles and the integer spin particles, excluding the fact that they have different names, of course, is that fermions are restricted to the Pauli exclusion principle. If you want to get a little bit of details on it, if you want even the slightest amount of details, you can go to episode 28. Or you can click some of the links down in the description, specifically down in the description of number 28, which essentially states that no two fermions, the Pauli exclusion principle essentially states that no two fermions can exist in identical quantum energy states. In the last chapter, I spoke specifically of electrons because of electron degeneracy pressure and its stabilization of white dwarf stars. The bosons, which have integer-valued spins, are not restricted to the Pauli exclusion principle and thus can accumulate and collect into the same energy state. Again, the quark is a fermion, meaning that it is restricted to the Pauli exclusion principle. I can't say exclusion for some reason. And thus, no two quarks can occupy the same quantum energy states. There are six quark flavors, as we discussed earlier. These flavors include the up quark, the down quark, the top quark, the bottom quark, the charm quark, and the strange quark. Each of these quarks has specific characteristics that are to be discussed below. Generally, just the basic general characteristics of it. We'll discuss mass, spin, well, all of them have the same spin. Energy, it's either plus two-thirds or minus one-third. A lot more. We'll discuss the superpartner particles. We'll discuss the anti-quark version of it and all that. It's going to be interesting. Before the six flavors are discussed, it is important that some parameters in these classifications are discussed. All quarks have half-integer valued spins, first of all. They decay through the weak nuclear force, which is mediated by the gluon, if you really want to get into the craziness. We discussed that in episode 19. If you would like to look at other episodes or find or research something on the gluon, and then also search up the gluon, G-L-U-O-N. I think the gluon is a very interesting particle, to be honest. It is the other massless particle, unless gravitons are found to be massless. It is the only other massless particle that mediates the forces, that basically transfers the forces, that is the messenger of the forces. So you have the photon, the W and Z bosons, the gluons, and potentially the gravitons. W and Z bosons are the... Well, actually, the W and Z bosons do the weak nuclear force, so that's what I said was incorrect. So the gluon is the strong nuclear force. It mediates a strong nuclear force. I kind of corrected myself while making the, while speaking the podcast. And yeah, and then the W and Z bosons are actually responsible for the weak nuclear force. And there are many reasons as to why it's the weak nuclear force rather than the strong nuclear force, because the W and Z bosons are very, very heavy particles, and they're not able to travel at relativistic speeds in any way. They actually can only really do anything at very short distances. They can't really move anywhere. They can't really do anything. And to go back to what we were supposed to be saying, all quarks have masses that are inaccurate and that have large margins of error, which are not represented in the descriptions of each quark. But if you go onto the Wikipedia pages, you'll see the crazy margins of error, because they are not close. They are not very confident on what that is, on what the mass is right now. The final major parameter is that the anti-quark is the antimatter variation of the normal quark, and is always represented with a line above any particle letter or particular letter classification of a quark flavor. So in this episode, we're going to be discussing each of the six quark flavors, and I will indicate what the typical notation looks like for an antiparticle version, so the anti-quark. But anyways, let's go into the quarks, and first we'll start with the up quark. The up quark is one of two quarks that make up typical atomic nuclei, and might mean typical atomic nuclei specifically, which is characterized by the denotation symbol of U, just straight up U. The up quark has a mass of around 2.2 mega electron volts per the speed of light squared. Yes, that is actually a mass, apparently. I learned that myself today, or not today, when I wrote this. It has a spin of 1/2, like all every single quark does, a charge of plus 2/3, an antiparticle partner known as the up antiquark, and decays into a down quark, or it decays into a down quark, a positron, or basically an anti-electron, and an electron neutrino. So we discussed the types of leptons earlier in this episode, and that's one of them. The up quark was first theorized in 1964 by the physicist who first proposed the quark model, and was subsequently discovered, and I mean discovered with quotation marks, in 1968. The up quark is the lightest of all the six quark flavors, being that it has a mass of only 2.2 mega electron volts per the speed of light squared. So you can assume that all the other quark flavors are going to have significantly greater masses than that of the up quark. The up quark is a positive quark in atomic nuclei that determines the positivity of the proton and the neutrality of the neutron. In the proton, there are two up quarks, collectively having a charge of 4/3, but the proton has a charge of plus 1, though, so there's undoubtedly a different quark lying in the shadows of the up quarks, and we will discuss that literally right after this. And in the neutron, there is one up quark carrying a charge of plus 2/3, but again, remember that the neutron has a neutral charge, so there must be something offsetting the positive charge of this up quark. Next, we're going to go to the down quark, because, of course, up, down, top, bottom. Well, actually, we're going up, down, strange, charm, and then bottom, top. So, yeah, this is a little unusual. It's based on when they were discovered, specifically. So, oddly enough, ironically enough, the charm quark and the strange quark, which are both way stranger than the top and the bottom quark, somewhat, are apparently more... They're harder to discover. They were discovered later. You would feel that the weird stuff would be discovered like more recently. But anyways, so the next one is the down quark, and the down quark is the second flavor of quark dominating the composition of typical protons and neutrons. So we discussed earlier about the charges. This is what mediates those charges. The down quark is represented by the letter D, and its antiparticle, the down antiquark, is represented by the letter D with a line above it. So like I'd like to think of the decimal of 1/3 and how one indicates that it's decimal repeats. You probably learned this in sixth grade math. I know I did. Well, I didn't take sixth grade math. I skipped, but seventh grade math, I guess. The down quark is characterized by having a mass of around 4.7 mega electron volts per the speed of light squared, a spin of 1/2, a charge of negative 1/3, and by decaying into it decays into an up quark, an electron, and an electron antineutrino. The two are essentially the reciprocals of one another when it comes to their decay. The up quark decays into a down quark, a positron, and an electron neutrino, while the up quark decays into a down quark. Yeah. And then while the down quark decays into an up quark, an electron and an electron neutrino, or antineutrino. So they're interestingly different, but they are almost like the reciprocals of one another. The down quark 2 was first hypothesized by the founders of the quark model and was 2 discovered in 1968 along with the up quark. The down quark is the mediator of the positive charges in both the protons and the neutrons. In the proton, there's a single down quark which contributes negative 1/3 to the plus 4/3 charge of the up quarks, thus making the 3 quark proton exist with a charge of plus 1. In the neutron, there are 2 down quarks which neutralizes, literally pun intended, the plus 2/3 charge of the single up quark and compose a neutron with a net 0 charge. Next, we're going to venture into the weird stuff, and by weird, I mean weird. It's literally called the strange quark, so be prepared. I mean, we're not going to get into the crazy stuff, but considering the strange quark is one of the most stable, is literally arguably the most stable thing that is known in the universe, even maybe potentially even more so than dark matter, it is likely, and I mean likely, and I mean probable, that there is something weird that goes on with strange quarks, and I assure you there are some weird things that go on with strange quarks. But anyways, we now venture out of the safe bounds of the composers of typical atomic nuclei and enter the realms of the unusual and the weird. We're not going to get into how the strange quark changes everything it makes contact with into the strange quark, but we'll get into stuff. We're just going to talk about the simple stuff. The strange quark is represented by the letter S and its anti-quark variant. The strange anti-quark is represented by the letter S with a line above it. I'm just going to keep saying that. The strange quark is characterized by having a mass of around 95 megaelectron volts per the speed of light squared, an electron charge or an electric charge of negative 1/3, so it's similar to that of the down quark, a spin of 1/2, and is characterized by decaying into an up quark, just straight up an up quark. The strange quark was first postulated in 1964 by the same two physicists who postulated the quark model. The strange quark was in the quark model itself so that it could explain the eightfold way in particle physics. I have a link down in the description if I'm not incorrect here. And it was first observed in 1968 when the up and down quarks were first observed. The strange quark is different from both the up quark and the down quark in the way that it occurs only in what are known as strange particles, which are composite particles, entirely hadrons, that contain strange quarks. They contain strange quarks. So anything that contains strange quarks is considered to be strange particles, strange matter, all that. Some examples of strange particles include kaons. I assume it's kaons. Strange D meson or mesons, sigma baryons, among numerous others. The next one we're going to go to is the little more charming of the quark flavors, and that is the charm quark. So obviously you see that it was pun intended. It's not April 1st, but it is in my mind. It's actually March 25th, but yeah, close enough. The charm quark is represented by the symbol C, and the charm anti-quark is represented by the symbol C with a line above it. This particular quark flavor is characterized by having a charge of plus 2/3, a spin of 1/2, a mass of 1.275 gigaelectron volts per the speed of light squared, and is characterized by decaying into a strange quark 95% of the time and into an up quark 5% of the time. The charm quark is the first of the flavors to be discovered, to have been discovered after the proposition of the quark model and the discovery of the first three quark flavors. This particular flavor was first theorized in 1970 by the physicists Sheldon Glashow, John Iliopoulos, and Luciano Maiani. And the particle was first observed in 1974, again at the Stanford Linear Accelerator. The charm quark ushered in what is known as the November Revolution, which was characterized by substantial changes, notably the global scientific acceptance and affirmation of the quark as the elementary particle in the proton and the neutron in the months, notably November, I assume, following the discovery of the charm quark. The charm quark exists in some composites, including the D meson or the D meson, the J slash psi meson, meson, and the charmed sigma baryon. So next we go to the two similar to up and down quarks, but not really. They just sound similar, like up, top, bottom, down, like very similar. But these are completely different. And when I say completely different, they are about as different as it gets. The bottom quark is represented by a B, and the bottom anti-quark is represented by a B with a line above it. The bottom quark is characterized as having a charge of negative 1/3, a spin of 1/2, a mass of anywhere from 4 to 5 gigaelectron volts per the speed of light squared. There are two different measurement systems that have major discrepancies in the mass of the bottom quark. And by decaying into almost exclusively the top quark, it can also decay into almost exclusively the top quark. But it can also decay into a charm quark or an up quark. So like hint for your own further research, both have charges of plus 2/3, while the bottom quark has a charge of negative 1/3. Interesting. I've kind of done some pattern sensing here. I feel like when a quark decays, it always decays into a quark that is basically the opposite of it, that has the opposite charge. That's what I've seen, but I'm probably not right. I'm not going to say that I'm right. I'm not going to propound this as a theory, and I do not ask you guys to believe me. It's pure speculation, but I assume it's probably correct. I guess just look it up. The bottom quark was first hypothesized by the physicists Makoto Kobayashi and Toshihide Maskawa in 1973 to explain the CP violation, which states that the laws of physics the laws of the universe must remain the same if a typical particle were to be replaced by an antiparticle, and that the only difference between the particle and the antiparticle is that they have dissimilar spatial characteristics, so specifically like different charges or something. It was discovered that certain types of weak decay, this is how quarks decay, violated CP symmetry. As was said earlier, the proposition of the bottom quark was an attempt to mediate these symmetry violations. In 1977, in suburban Illinois's Fermi Lab, known as the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, we've discussed this before, the bottom quark was first proven to exist, but the CP violation was not fully mediated. There are some discrepancies with the weak nuclear force, but yeah. The bottom quark has a mass much greater than that of the up and down quarks, and even protons and neutrons themselves, and yet the bottom quark is not the most massive of the quarks. That's another reason why both of them were kind of, it was twofold the way I organized the order of this. First of all, we're doing it chronologically from oldest to newest discovery, but also we're doing it based on mass. The up quark has the lowest mass and the top quark has the greatest mass. But anyways, bottom quarks are present in B mesons, upsilon mesons, and various bottom baryons, bottom being bottom matter, bottom quark matter. But anyways, to the last one, finally, the top quark, of course, which is represented by the symbol T and its antiparticle partner, the top antiquark, which is represented by that same T, this one, of course, having a line above this T. The top quark has a spin of 1/2, just like all the quarks, a charge of +2/3, and a mass around a lot larger. Remember how the bottom quark was 4 to 5 gigaelectron volts per the speed of light squared? This is 172.76 gigaelectron volts per the speed of light squared. And much, much greater than that of all the other, literally much greater than that of all the other quarks combined. And it also decays into a bottom quark 99.8% of the time, a strange quark 0.17% of the time, and a down quark 0.007% of the time. The top quark was first hypothesized in the same time frame as the bottom quark. It was hypothesized in 1973 by the same two physicists who proposed the bottom quark to mediate the CP violation, but was discovered much later than that of the bottom quark. In March 1995, physicists at Fermi Lab officially declared the discovery of the sixth quark, the top quark. The top quark has by far the greatest mass of all the quarks, with a mass of around 173 gigaelectron volts per the speed of light squared. This is because the top quark experiences a coupling with the Higgs boson, known as the Higgs-Yukawa coupling, that is far greater than that of other quark flavors. If one were to put these couplings in numerical values, the electron would experience a small coupling of 2 times 10 to the negative 6th power, while the top quark experiences a far larger coupling of 1. 500,000 times less. It's 500,000 times stronger than that of the electron. But also the electron's not that massive at all. Additionally, the top quark is the shortest living of all the quarks, decaying into other particles. Almost universally, the bottom quark, after only 5 times 10 to the negative 25th power seconds. I'm not going to put that into numbers, because that's such a small number. Thus making the top quark the most unstable and shortest living of the quarks. Let's just say, good thing that the top quark is not a primary particle in atomic nuclei, because, well, we would probably not exist. There is quite a bit more to the quark than was presented in this chapter, so of course it is recommended that all readers and listeners look through some of the links in the description and do some further research. Anyways, to recap, a quark is a 1/2 integer valued spin fermion whose charge can be, as is so far understood, only +2/3 and -1/3. The quarks are the building blocks of a significant proportion of hadronic matter, basically all of it, and notably baryonic matter. Typical nucleons, meaning the protons and the neutrons, are entirely constituted of quarks, notably up and down quarks exclusively. Without quarks, protons and neutrons, among a vast majority, pretty much literally all of the other hadrons, would not exist, and we too would not exist. I said likely, but we would not exist. Quarks are obviously an integral part of our lives, even though we don't really realize it. The quark constitutes the matter we are born from and the matter that powers the stars and the galaxies. Without the quark, it is likely the universe would be almost irrevocably dissimilar to the universe in which we live and love. Anyways, thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. If you would like to support the channel and help me pay for college, I would greatly appreciate it if you would just support my channel through the link in the description of my channel. You could give me a cent, and that would be perfectly fine with me. I'll take a cent. I'll take 2 cents. I'll take $1 trillion. I'll take whatever you wish. Yeah. But anyways, take care and stay curious.